Welcome to Life Solved, the research podcast from the University of Portsmouth, where we explore how studies here are changing our world today and in the future. I'm Robin Montague, and in this episode, we take a look at the realities of crime scene investigation, or CSI. Zoe Cadwell from the University of Portsmouth and Selena Robinson from Winchester University both used to be crime scene investigators.
I think it's such a fast-moving field, so what was advanced 5 years ago might not actually be as advanced now. And that's the great thing about forensics, because like there's an appetite for it. It's always evolving, it's always advancing, which is great, but it still builds on the foundations of original concepts of recovery.
So how does the CSI activity we see in films and TV dramas compare to the real world? How do investigations differ around the world? And what are the myths of crime scene investigation? Join us as Zoe and Selena walk us through our fictitious podcast crime scene. If you think you'd like a career in crime scene investigation because you're solving the mystery before the actor manages it on your TV screen, then Selena can assure you that you're not on your own, although the reality rarely matches the fiction.
I think I went into crime scene investigation, as we all do, because we have this desire to want to solve a mystery, I suppose. I think, unfortunately, suspicious and unsuspicious deaths are going to be something that continues, so there's not going to be a lack of that. And it was really an exciting prospect, a unique career, something physical, something challenging, something that was really cool. And yeah, I was sadly quite disappointed when I became a crime scene investigator. Not because the job wasn't fantastic, not because of the people, but I think the changes that were implemented into the landscape of forensics is really changing how you do the role.
I think my experience is slightly different because I'm slightly older than Selena. So I came into the role many, many years ago, over 20 years ago. And at that time, it wasn't really well known what this role was, and there was no TV shows. So a lot of people, I think, now see the TV shows and think that's what I want to do, whereas that exposure wasn't in place. I'd read books as a child, crime books, and seen photographs of crime scenes and said that's what I want to do, even though I didn't know what the job was. And I actually studied archaeology. So as an archaeologist, you excavate pieces of evidence and you look at the surroundings and you pick those tiny little pieces of artifacts and evidence together and try and interpret what happened for those things to be where they are, where you found them. And actually that transposes really well into crime scene investigation. There's actually quite a lot of people who have studied archaeology that become crime scene investigators. So it has these transferable skills, and it is about that mystery solving and putting jigsaws together with little tiny pieces of evidence. When I got into the role, it was everything I hoped it would be. But of course, I didn't have all this overexposure and expectation. And yeah, I got to solve mysteries, not on my own, but as part of a wider, really important team within policing. And I really enjoyed it.
From archaeology in Indiana Jones movies to swabs on CSI Miami, popular culture has certainly created interest in the profession.
We saw a massive uptick in applications to crime scene investigation roles once these shows hit the TV. And I think there's the drama side of it. Personally, I think they glamorise the role. CSI, I think, was probably the first one, the main one. And it was so glamorous. They all had perfect hair and perfect nails and heels and a gun, which obviously no one's ever let me have a gun.
They could smoke in the crime scene and wear their sunglasses.
So I think it was the glamorisation of solving crime, but it wasn't police officers. It was people who were using science and some new kind of sexy subjects that perhaps hadn't been explored on TV before.
So what have TV dramas and films got completely wrong when it comes to a career in CSI?
I think the biggest myth is that it's all about murder, and the TV shows, Silent Witness, CSI, they're always predominantly focused on the most serious crimes, which is murder. But actually, as crime scene investigators, our day-to-day or bread and butter investigations tend to be what we call volume crimes. So volume crime is defined as something that happens so frequently. So things generally, vehicle crime and property crime, so burglaries to houses and burglaries to commercial premises. So people don't really realise that that's actually what we're kind of doing day in, day out. What we call the bigger jobs, the major crime jobs, are not happening, thankfully, every day. And really, we're out there talking to members of the public that are victims of crime. And I think that's really the day-to-day job that goes unnoticed.
But let's stay in the pretend world for a little longer and explore the myths versus reality in a scene from the UK's Silent Witness TV series. For rights reasons, we can't actually play the clip that they play into their students, so we'll have to leave it to our producer Rick to set the scene.
I'll certainly do my best. Three people and an employee are shot dead by a long-range sniper on a garage forecourt. A seemingly motiveless crime. Dr. Nikki Alexander and her colleague Jack Hodgson pull up to the crime scene in their unmarked police vehicle. They present their police IDs to the on-duty officer before being left behind the tape. They drive past the police cordon and spot two bodies laying on top of each other. The pair get out of the car and put white coveralls over their clothes, leaving their faces and hands exposed. A police detective in plain clothes shows them over to the crime scene, sharing what they know about the shooting. So far, Nikki is showing the two bodies that are on top of each other and places her equipment box next to the victims. While Jack goes to another part of the petrol station forecourt, where there is a third body laying on the floor, Nikki joins him before all three characters go back to the first body.
Okay, let's deconstruct that. First, this bit.
Dr. Nikki Alexander and her colleague Jack Hodgson pull up to the crime scene in their unmarked police vehicle.
First of all, they drive the vehicle straight into the scene, straight next to where the bodies are. That is what we would call the inner cordon, so the forensically rich area of the scene is where we would want to eliminate any unnecessary personnel. We wouldn't want any vehicles in there. We wouldn't want any unnecessary equipment. So usually in the inner cordon, it is only the forensic personnel that are there. If somebody from the investigation team needs to come and see the scene, there's usually maybe one, maybe two, but that's really, from my experience, really rare, and they would be in full PPE as well. So all the walking around without any PPE on is a bit of a problem. And the vehicle, really, that was the bit that got me, was the vehicle just driving up to the bodies, basically.
Okay, Zoe, next bit.
A police detective in plain clothes shows them over to the crime scene, sharing what they know about the shooting.
Just going over to the body and then having a conversation literally over the top of the body, and then everyone moving over to the other body. In a scene like that, it's highly likely we would treat them, even though they're all in one scene, we'd treat them very separately because they might have trace evidence on one body that's not on another one. For example, one of the bodies could have come into contact with the offender and the other bodies haven't. And if you move between the two, you're transporting that or transferring that trace evidence between them.
And what about Nikki and Jack's roles? Are they realistic?
That TV show does somewhat blur the roles. I appreciate they can't have all of the people because it would get very confusing, but certainly she does a lot of police work rather than sticking to the pathology work. And Jack, I just don't even know what his job is.
That said, Selena points out that Silent Witness and many other TV dramas get a lot of the reality right too.
That gives a real snippet of the working environment, the pressures that they're under, and also the time constraints. I think sometimes it's like, why aren't the police doing anything? Why is this not happening? But there's so much to do behind the scenes that we can't let the public know. And so that's really quite good at managing expectations of, all right, so they're not just sitting there waiting for the result to come back. Although actually we do, it does take, it can take 24 hours. It can take longer than that.
Here are some Life Solve podcast recommendations. Life's too short to fully examine it, but here are some podcasts to help you make some progress. The Partially Examined Life Philosophy podcast is a deep dive philosophy reading group that's been downloaded nearly 50 million times. Based on its success, host Mark Linsenmeyer started the Nakedly Examined Music podcast, featuring career-spanning interviews with songwriters. You get to hear some great songs and learn about the creative decisions behind them. But maybe you're not that geeky about music or philosophy. Well, try Mark's Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast, where diverse panels of guests examine what we watch or otherwise consume. Finally, for the philosophy beginner who's not adverse to some comedy thrown into the mix, try Philosophy versus Improv. Mark and Chicago improv comedy instructor Bill Arnett teach each other their respective arts and bring on professional philosophers and/or performers to keep things lively. Find out about all of Mark's podcasts at partiallyexaminedlife.com or look up The Partially Examined Life, Nakedly Examined Music, Pretty Much Pop, and Philosophy versus Improv wherever you listen. If you're enjoying Life Solved, the research podcast from the University of Portsmouth, then you might like one of our other episodes. From space, fabrics, films, environment, human biology, philosophy, and much more, there's an episode for you. Why not try Understanding Missing Persons, episode 3 of season 9, back in September 2022.
I think it's one of those myths that exist that we'd really like the public to be aware of, that if you cannot identify their whereabouts, you are concerned, call the police. Don't delay that, because what it means is by the time police services mobilize, that person is already off, and it makes finding them more difficult.
All the episodes from our first 11 series are available to stream for free wherever you listen to your podcasts. As we continue our investigation into CSI fact and fiction, how long do the investigations take in real life compared to a TV drama?
How long's a piece of string, really? Volume crime are always going to naturally be quicker, especially if it's just yourself in a two-bedroom house, one-bedroom flat. You know, that's ultimately going to be quicker. Sometimes they do take longer if it's a lovely, affluent property. But major crimes, depending on the type of crime, depending on how many resources you need, because if we do need to call from forensic specialism within the department, then we need to wait for them to arrive, we need to wait for them to finish, and then we can go back in and support it. But I think the crime scene managers that I've worked with have been really good at trying to manage the welfare of the crime scene investigators within the scene of a major crime. So it's usually, can I go to get a coffee? Can I get anyone some lunch? But usually I feel we're quite the same. Once you're in there, you just want to do it, just want to get as much done, do as much as you can do before you absolutely have to clock off. And then in those circumstances where it may have to go into the next sort of shift, they'll seal the property up, have a guard at the door or outside of the area, and then you'll have to return the next day.
I think I've had scenes that have been open for weeks and go back every day, and then it tails off to a point and things get left, and then you go back because it just gets sealed and there's certain other things or other specialists that need to come. So I think you can fully expect sort of long 12, 15 hour days in the initial stages of a murder inquiry. And then that might tail off in terms of how many times you need to revisit. But I remember a murder scene where I had to revisit it a number of times over about 3 or 4 weeks. After that, usually for contamination reasons, the CSIs that work at the scene tend to be the ones that go to the post-mortem, because we only have a finite number of CSIs, so you can't use a new set and they've already been in contact with the body. I think the quickest forensic postmortem I've ever been to was about 30 minutes and the longest was about 8 or 10 hours.
What's the reality of working a CSI scene? Well, here's how it works in the UK.
In most police forces, there's two levels of CSI, a level one and a level two. They might have slightly different names depending on different forces call their staff different titles. But essentially, you're trained initially to do the volume crime work, and then you get trained to be able to do the major crime work. And then above that, you can be trained to be a crime scene manager. So that's the person that's in charge of the staff at that scene. But it is the county employed or the police force employed CSIs that will come, whoever's on duty, whoever's got the required training to come and do that scene. We might bring specialists in from what we call forensic science providers. So they are the laboratories that work externally to the police where we submit our evidence for analysis. So these might be blood spatter experts, so that forensic biologists. If it's a shooting, there may be a forensic ballistic expert. And of course, the pathologist that we see in so many of the TV programmes is an external person as well that may come to the scene, but more likely will encounter them at the mortuary.
And who's in charge, for want of a better word, at a crime scene? TV drama can make it so confusing. Is it the detective, the senior investigating officer, or someone else?
In a volume crime scene, it's the CSI, because there's usually just you there. You're the only person there with the victim of crime. So it's up to you. In a major crime, it's the crime scene manager. So they work out the strategy with the senior investigating officer. They work out the forensic strategy, what's priority, what needs to be done in the order things are done. And the CSIs do follow that strategy. It's very rare for detectives to be in the scene. That's another thing that's quite unusual in the TV shows. In my experience, the SIO certainly is very busy in a briefing room at headquarters, coordinating lots and lots of investigative leads. So they are not there walking around the scene. It tends to just be the forensic team. Because with advances in technology now as well, we can get our images out to the briefing room from the scene really quickly, so that that way we can minimise the number of people that are in that scene, which is really important for contamination.
That's the UK picture, but how does it compare to other countries?
First year students, the first lecture I have with them, I always do this sort of myth busting. So what do you know about forensic science? What do you know about crime scene investigation? And one of the things that comes up every year is the role of the coroner, because in the shows from the USA, the coroner is essentially what we would call the forensic pathologist. So the person that does the post-mortem or the autopsy in America. And often they come to the scene and no one's allowed to do anything with the body until the coroner has been and they examine the body at the scene, etc. Here, that's a forensic pathologist, and our coroner is a very different role and is a completely different person. So the coroner does not come to the scene in the UK. The forensic pathologist might, and they undertake the post-mortem, not the coroner. So we have a distinction in terms of wording, I think, and roles there. I think it's probably fair to say in other countries, the role of the CSI is a police officer. And I think that's something we need to bust as well. In the UK, you do not need to be a police officer first to become a CSI. You get the job as a CSI and you're trained on the job. In the US, predominantly, you are a police officer, sworn police officer, and then you train to be a CSI. And that's the case in many other countries. Australia is the same, but it's moving. I think there are some police staff CSIs now. I think it's moving towards that.
And as Zoe continues her deep dive into varying CSI practices across the world, if you're a little squeamish, look away now.
I did a module in forensic biology with an American university, and they taught me about air dry and swabs. Dry blood stains is our method for recovery, and then we freeze those swabs. But in the US, or particularly the state that I was being taught this module, they were teaching us to air dry. And I spoke to the lecturer and I said, oh, that's very, very different to what we do. If we air dried them, that would be an issue in terms of contamination, and also related to how they were packaging and storing them. And we had a really, really interesting conversation about it, and I had to write an essay based on their practices. But I also wrote two essays because I'm a bit of a geek, and I wrote one from our perspective as well. And we afterwards had another really interesting chat about the two perspectives on this one tiny element of evidence recovery. And so that's just one tiny example of how there are different approaches across the world.
You say air dry blood, I say frozen blood. Let's call the whole thing off. But actually, despite their different practices, countries are working more effectively together these days when it comes to CSI.
I think improve is the buzzword at the moment. I think although forensics has been on the forefront of all criminal investigations, I think there is probably room and appetite for improvements to be standardised across all the countries. And I think standardisation is also key as well, because even though there may be some different practices or methods or techniques that's being utilised, it doesn't mean that it's wrong. It just means that we get there in a different way. Certainly within the UK, England, Wales, we're trying to standardise the practices, the methods, the techniques, the recording.
Like Celine said, I would like to say that no one's saying that anyone's doing it right or wrong. What we need to do is learn from each other, and where's our evidence for doing it this way? Where's your evidence for doing it that way? Can we put that evidence together and come up with really the optimum way? But we do see differences within our own country, not just with countries around the world as well.
And wherever you are in the world, CSI techniques continue to develop apace.
I think it's such a fast-moving field. So what was advanced 5 years ago might not actually be as advanced now. And that's the great thing about forensics, because like there's an appetite for it. It's always evolving. It's always advancing, which is great, but it still builds on the foundations of original concepts of recovery. So fingerprinting hasn't really changed, actually, probably from when I started. Even now, what the students are learning is very much the same as what it was. But there are slightly different techniques, a little bit more advanced about how we analyze it, how we interpret it. It's a holistic approach really that's advancing, as opposed to the changes of how we just recover evidence.
I think the major change for me has been DNA. I started at a time when to recover DNA, we had to have a significant, really visible stain, so it would be blood or something. And now, of course, we're down to cellular level of DNA recovery. So for me, that's the biggest change in technology. But some of the underlying changes that perhaps we might learn a little bit more about as academics, and then hopefully we'll see filter through to practitioners, is about how we think as CSIs. So when I started, there was not much thinking about thinking, and now there's an awful lot of thinking about thinking. How do we do this? But why do we do it? Why am I doing this? Why am I feeling the way I'm feeling? Am I being biased by anything in this case or in this crime scene that's altering my approach to it? So for me, that's a really exciting change and development in crime scene investigation that perhaps people don't talk about so much, is definitely the thought processes and the decision making.
Because of TV and film dramas, we've already got a picture of how CSI works and the terms used in forensics. But hopefully in this episode, we've corrected a few things and given an idea of how it works in reality and how it can vary across the world. CSI teams are a key part of crime solving, but are often misunderstood. So it's good to know how the process really works, while still being able to enjoy all the imperfections of the likes of Silent Witness. As they say, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. We'd love you to be a part of the discussion. Email us at lifesolved@port.ac.uk. That's lifesolved, one word, at port.ac.uk. Tell us what you think and make suggestions for future episodes of Life Solved. In the meantime, you can get news of the latest developments here at the university by going to our website, port.ac.uk. And we'd love if you clicked follow on your podcast app so you never miss an edition. We'd really appreciate it if you left a rating or a review as well. It helps us get these conversations out into more ears around the globe. Next time, nature's role in cleaning up our seas and rivers.
What we're hoping to do is two things, really, to see if we can grow this commercially important species in places like Langston Harbour, but also to see how good it is at absorbing the nutrients from the water.
Are you a fan of seaweed? Would you eat what you can see?
I have eaten seaweed in the past, and it's not for everyone, but it's okay, yeah.
Bye for now.